I guess it's one of the professors academy named an associate printer, but this is the first time I've actually gotten to it. Though I was in Waterloo 22 years ago for 6 weeks before I got married to my wife in London, Ontario. But I don't remember much about Waterloo. It's more of like going to London. So
anyway, okay, so this is the original title. Well, the Born Real Fails in Cosmology, I guess, was the official title. I originally called it just to kind of connect with Born. The Born Rule Dies, and it's based on these four papers, mostly the last one. This one, JCAP did insist I change the title to the Born Rule to something else. So I said the Born Rule Fails in Cosmology, because someone said, well, a rule can't die, which I guess is true. so anyway, I'm going to complain. I'm going to at least argue that it perhaps inapplicable in quantum theory. So. Okay, so I'm taking sort of a big picture thing. Well, what do we want for complete theory of the universe? Now, of course, we're not close to getting a complete theory, but this is, you know, what would we desire for that? Well, first, we might want the kinematics. We want the physical variables. And in quantum theory, you might say, well, those would be the arguments of the wave function or wave function. Then you'd like the dynamical laws. What are the equations governing this wave functional or wave function? Sometimes particle physicists tend to call this a theory of everything, but I'm claiming it's clearly not. It's just the second step in a whole sequence of things that we need. Third, you need boundary conditions. You need some sort of quantum state. We had a proposal this morning for what the quantum state was in terms of this effective action for a conformal field theory, but then and also Harlan Hawking have a proposal. Various people have proposals for one. I just put one myself on the archive on Friday for these things. But today I'm going to focus on another aspect that I don't think it's not determined by the first three, is the probability rules. How do you get probabilities out from the wave function? So in particular, I'll talk about that Born's rule seems not to work in cosmology, and we need some analog of that, but it doesn't seem to be logically determined what it is. Now, I won't talk much other than this slide, that you could still raise the question, what is it that has probabilities? For this talk, it's not important. I mean, I can lay my cards on the table, and for me, I believe it's conscious perceptions. But everybody can have their own opinion about that. Does it really relate to this part? And then you can ask, well, what do the probabilities mean? You know, some people say that there are propensities for potentialities to be converted to actualities. I can say personally, I believe in something like an Everett view that there's no collapse of the wave function. So I regard them as basically measures for many different actualities. Some of them have more measures, so in some sense they exist more. But again, it's probably not too important whether I answer this question. I'm going to go to that. Okay, so I'm saying at least a goal of science or an ultimate goal of science might be that we would like complete theories, and let's suppose for simplicity there's discrete, so I'll put T sub I. I'll imagine that, you know, we can write it down in a finite number of symbols in a book or something, and we want each of them to predict normalized probabilities of observations, and OJ all to symbolize an observation, so the probability, and has two indices, well, an index which is of the observation, and then it depends on the theory. And that's the probability of the observation given the theory. And I would like these to be normalized, so the sum of the probabilities for all of the observations for any given theory, any good theory, is equal to 1. So now let's discuss the Born's rule. So traditional quantum theory uses Born's rule that says that the probabilities of observations are given by expectation values of projection operator. So that P with the two vertical lines is supposed to represent an operator. So you say, okay, that you have some operator for each possible observation, so the index J to which observation, and then you take the expectation value of that in the quantum state given by the theory I. So that's represented by these angular brackets. It gives the expectation value. So if it were a pure quantum state, for example, denoted by this bra and ket, then it would just be this standard thing. But I want to allow it more general. I mean, maybe the theory predicts a density matrix, or maybe it predicts just a C-star algebra state. But I'm supposing that at least in the quantum theory, it's something will give you, the quantum state will allow you to get expectation values of operators. So now Born's rule does seem to work well in single laboratory settings where you have a definite observer and it can distinguish between a set of mutually exclusive outcomes so that you can exclude, you can't get more than one outcome, I mean, assuming you're fixing on this one laboratory with one observer. But I'm claiming it does not work in a universe large enough that the same observation may occur at different locations. So that there may be a copy, no matter how finely you describe your laboratory or your local situation, if the universe is big enough that there could be a copy somewhere else, then I'm saying that the Born rule doesn't work. So for this, I found it convenient to use language that I picked up from Tegmark, although someone said maybe it goes back to Freeman Dyson, of imagining different beings thinking. You can think of a putative super observer that can see the entire universe, or if you want to make measurements in the entire universe, or know the quantum state. And Tegmark's language is called the bird. But I want to get probabilities that can be tested by us frogs within the universe, localized by a frog as a localized observer that can see only the local part. It can only see what you have access to, or you could say see within what's in our past light cone. But you can't see everything, can't see out beyond that thing. So okay, so let's illustrate. The problem with Born's rule is sort of a toy model where we imagine just having a discrete number of regions. So let's suppose that space-time, let's see, I guess I can move this one down a bit so not to strain your book so much. Okay, so let's suppose that space-time had in regions. I don't really mean that it has definitely, you know, it's presumably a continuum, but I just for the sake of discussion, I want to imagine that we can just imagine partitioning up into in separate regions. And that suppose that a bird could, you know, distinguish the regions. I mean, maybe there's an end or something inhomogeneous, so the bird can tell the difference between the regions. But suppose the local observations by frogs do not determine which region you're in. You can't, the frog can only see what's around you. The frog can't tell where he is in the global thing. So now let's suppose that each region is small enough that that we can neglect the probability if the same observation occurs twice within one single region. So under that assumption, let's suppose that within each region, then you have these projection operator for observation J within the region L and K within the region L. And suppose that if you get one, well, basically I want to say that if you make one observation within a region, you can't get the other one. There's only one possible observation within that region, so it evades its usual projection operator within that. But on the other hand, if you go to different regions, then the product of these are not necessarily zero, because you could indeed have the observation J in region L and the different observation K in the different region M. Whereas here, I'm assuming the region is small enough that you only get the one observation. There's maybe the region small enough to only one observer there. Okay, so now it's a question, well, what could you do? If you try to retain Born's rule, you might say, well, okay, we want some projection operator for this observation. And you might say, well, we'll just pick a region and do that. But the trouble is, of course, the frog has no access to knowing what the region is. So you can't, for the frog, you can't really just say, well, you choose some particular L, because the frog doesn't know what that is. Now, another thing you might do, and this was what, for at one period of time, Jim Harlan, Mark Stronecki suggested calculating the probability that the observation occurs at least once somewhere. And so you could make up, if these separate ones commute, you could say the projection operator into the existence at least once would be this, where of course I minus, I is the identity operator, I minus that is the projection operator to that thing not occurring. And so if it doesn't occur in, and then the product means, you know, it doesn't occur in any one of the regions. And so I minus that is the probability occurs at least once. So you could try that. But then, of course, the sums of these probabilities would be greater than one, because, you know, you could have, if you had two possibilities, say, of spin up or spin down, you might have, you know, universe that has spin down, one guy sees spin up down here, another one sees spin up over there, and so the probability would be unity that somebody sees spin up and probably unity that one sees spin down, so you'd have two units there, and so that would be greater than. So you can't just simply use that either. So it seems like the Born rule doesn't work when there may be copies of the observer. So I'm in crude terms, I might say the Bird rule dies. Another thing I've used is that you might say, well, it works for the bird, but not for the frog. So I could say Born's rule is for the birds. But okay, let me show in a little more detail. Dolmerov suggested, well, I should have a proof of this other than just asserting it. So let's give a particular example of a toy model to give a proof that this doesn't work under certain assumptions that I'm arguing are reasonable. So let's suppose that the quantum state is, well, in principle could be a superposition over components that have different numbers of regions. Now, for this part of the proof, I'm only going to assume that there's two regions. But in general, for later use, I can imagine that it may be a superposition over different regions, and these different in some sense could model different sizes of the universe if you consider inflation. You might say, you know, there's one component of the universe when you have this much inflation, another when you had another amount. That's for later use. For this part, I don't need that. So on this slide, let's just imagine that the universe, it definitely has two regions. And let's even make it simpler, and let's suppose that there's two possible observations that could occur in each region, which I could label by either one or two. And so, of course, there are four possible things that could happen. I mean, assuming there really is an observation in each region, I could have 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 1, or 2, 2. And for simplicity, let's, just to simplify the proof, I have a slightly longer proof in the paper, if I allowed all four in there. But let's suppose that that we consider states of this form. It's a superposition of these two component states with these coefficients, and it's normalized. So this state means that the first slot means region L equals 1, the first region, and it has observation 1. The 1 there means, and the second slot means L equals 2, and the number there means it's a second observation. So this one, of course, has observation 2 in the first slot, observation 1 in the second slot. So now I'm arguing, and let's suppose that these two observations are sufficiently similar, they're like spin up and spin down, you wouldn't think there's anything intrinsic about it that would favor one or the other. And so I'm arguing, in this case, each component of the quantum state has the same number of observation ones as twos. There's one of each. So by symmetry, it would seem very reasonable to expect that we should say that the probabilities are equal for the two observations. In each component, there's an equal number of observations, 1 and 2. So if there's nothing favoring one side over the other, or if there's nothing intrinsically different about the, well, really significantly different about the two observations, I'd expect the two probabilities to be equal, and of course, to be normalized, the two divides would have to be a half. So now the point is, there are not projection operators in this subspace whose expectation value give that for all possible values of these amplitudes. So I can't, there's no rule that will have a projection operator that will reproduce these probabilities and work no matter what the state is there. So I think it's sort of obvious, but let's just say out of detail. I mean, suppose we did choose a projection operator P1 and P2 and chosen to be, well, rank one projection operators. And so this has this form and that has that form. Then I'm saying, okay, then if the state happened to be these coefficients of the state were that, so that the actual state is the same as this one, then of course the expectation by this projection operator is just unity, and the other thing, which is an orthogonal state, is just zero, and of course those one and zero are not the same as a half. So you don't get it. I mean, it doesn't come out right. Now, somebody could say that, of course, somehow if you knew what this state was, you could make this one sort of like 45 degrees away from whatever the state is, and this 45 degree in the other way. You could, if you chose the projection operators after knowing the state, you could get a half for each one, but that's sort of cheating. I mean, you want to have a rule that tells you what the projection operators and it should apply for any state. You don't want to have to choose the projection operators after the state, or else, you know, you can get any answer you want no matter what the state is. The state would be sort of irrelevant for the answer because you would have just made up the rule to give you the answer independent of the state. Okay, well, let's see, maybe I'm going to go on to some ideas about possible replacements, but maybe I should ask, is there any question? This is sort of maybe the heart of the proof that there at least exists the example where Born's rule doesn't work, so maybe I should ask. It's the main message I want to go, that it doesn't work, but then I want to speculate about replacements and so on. Yes?
The sum of the two projection operators, in other words, if you have some sort of Everett idea where instead of projecting onto that state, you project onto both, and both possibilities exist afterwards, does that fix this problem?
Yeah, well, you can normalize it, and that's a partial way. So, I think that leads into the next. Into the next part. So, okay, so hopefully there wasn't anything technically wrong with the proof, at least, well, past the referees. Anyway. Okay, so now, the title, the original title didn't, but, okay, so now we have to think about, well, what can we replace it with? And I don't have a unique answer. I have some sort of tentative personal, you know, preference at the moment. So some principles we might use, this one, I have the cumbersome name, no extra vision principle. The probabilities of observations that have zero amplitudes to occur anywhere in the quantum state are zero, that you can't see what's not there in the quantum state. I mean, if there's zero probability as seen by the bird for this observation to occur anywhere, then, you know, I'm just assuming that nobody within the universe will actually see it. Now, you know, that's an assumption, but I mean, it's assuming the observations really depend on the quantum state. Okay, then. The one that I did use in the previous slide was this probability symmetric principle. If the quantum state's an eigenstate of equal numbers of observations of two different observations, then the probabilities of the two observations are equal. So let's say if each component had 1-1 and 1-2, so that the it was equal numbers, so then the probabilities of that were equal. Now, I could go on to something that's a bit stronger. It's not implied by this. Of course, it does imply that. If the quantum state's an eigenstate of the fraction of the number of each possible observation to the total number of possible observations, then the probability of each observation is that fraction. So this might be a simple, you know, if you say that we've got a, you know, a certain number of observers and a certain fraction see something, then the probability would be that fraction. So I think this is a reasonable thing to postulate, but as you'll see, even all these three don't uniquely tie things down. Yeah, it's sort of a typicality. Yeah, it's a typicality. So it's basically saying that it's. So I guess most of us at least believe in typicality would probably, you know, accept that. You know, I mean, maybe somebody would not, but. Okay, so. Now, in the case when there's a fixed number of sites where there can be observations, then I think there's rather a preferred answer, or at least one that I would prefer, or I think other people would perhaps agree. So if there's a fixed number of sites, and then we could get the probabilities by just normalizing some unnormalized probabilities, so it's easier to talk about the unnormalized ones with the lowercase p. So then you could just choose the lowercase ones to just be the expectation number of that observation, and that's basically just summing the projection over all of the sites, because I'm assuming that, you know, you get at most one observation per site, so just sum that over that. So it's the expectation of the value of the number of that. So for example, if I have two sites, then consider all four components, which I had in the paper, but it just makes the proof a little bit longer if you have all four components allowed there. Then, of course, the projection operator on to observation one at the first site is this, and of course this, because it has observation one at the first site. The observation one at the second site is this, and so on for this for the second observation at the first site. You have to have two in the first place, observation two at the second site, two there. So the expectation operator for observation one is the sum of that plus that. So you get a two here because of course there's two places where that observation occurs twice, so it counts double. And then for the other one, you get this sort of thing. Of course, you get zero for coefficient of that because that doesn't give any observation two. So then you can get the unnormalized probabilities by this, and so you just get a factor two squared that and so on. And then we all assume that the wave function is normalized. So if you add up these two things that are going to go in the denominator, that just adds up to 2. So the probability of observation 1 is this. The probability of observation 2 is that. And you can see, indeed, of course, if the B, like in the earlier slide, when this was absent and this was absent, and then because the wave function is normalized, this plus this squared is 1, so that P1 was a half and P2 is a half. On the other hand, of course, if the state was entirely this with 1, 1, then of course you'd get only this term, and P1 would be 1 and P2 would be 0. And conversely, if it was entirely this thing, then you would get that 0. So this is the reasonable, and as I say, if you have anything of that form, then the probability is a half. But this probability, it's not equal to the expectation value of any projection operators that are fixed independent of the quantum state. So this is not Born's rule. It's using expectation values of the numbers of the operators. Okay, now the part where it gets more obviously ambiguous is the case where you have where the wave function is a superposition of different values of n, different sizes of the universe, different numbers of regions. So I think what's been implicitly used in much of the discussion of the measure problem in cosmology is the analog of what I might call volume weighting, where you just do the same thing as I did on the previous slide of having the unnormalized probability be the expectation value of the number of a certain kind of each observation. So if we had this number operator, you know, if there's one site and the observation's j, then you get there with the coefficient 1. If there's two sites and you've got both, and the same observation occurs both places, there's a factor of 2 in the front, then here, of course, there's a 1. I'm assuming L is different from j, so there's only one site which has j, and each of those is a coefficient 1, and then, you know, 3 in front of the ones with 3 observations of j, and so on and so on. Now, another idea which has occurred to me might be better for helping to ameliorate the Boltzmann brain problem is to do volume averaging. So in this case, you take the unnormalized probability to be the expectation value of the fraction of all the sites that have the observation j. So the fraction, so I take this number operator, but then for each number of sites, I divide by n. So I don't give, you know, components of the wave function with larger values of n, assuming they have the same fraction of observers, are going to count more because there's just more observations of that. I say, well, maybe one shouldn't do that. Maybe you should divide by the number of sites there. So in this case, you're dividing by that, you'll get this, and you'll notice that even if all of the sites are the observation, you get a 1 in front of that, and then here we get a half times 2. So again, you get a 1. If it's all j's, then you have the same factor in front. And similarly, if there's 3 of them, you get the same factor front. It doesn't make any difference how many there are if all the observations. Yes.
So the volume averaging still has the idea that there's sort of different volumes. There's different regions.
There's different regions.
You discount the volume, but you still have some other way of noticing if it's in a totally different region.
Well, I'm imagining the universe is very big,
I'm just imagining that maybe that, I mean, I'm being a bit vague as to how big each individual region is, but I'm, you know, I suppose I could imagine each, pardon?
One is where you are in some particular volume, and the other is which region you're in.
Well, is the N, the capital N labels
how many regions? So if I imagine each region is having the same size, the capital N labels the total volume of the whole universe as seen by the bird. So the individual observer doesn't see that. He can only see what's within his local region. Then there's the label L, which labels which of those regions the observer is. And that, again, is accessible to the bird. He can see where you are. But you're within a particular region, and you can't see which region you're in because anything that you can see, I will regard as part of your observation. But if you can't see it, it's you know, where you are within the whole thing, it's not in there. So therefore, you know, if somebody sees J, he doesn't know whether he's seen J in the single region that exists, or whether it's two regions, and or maybe two regions and he's on the left side, or if he's on the right side. I mean, assuming there's a distinction as seen by the bird, and so on. So this one, this is in some sense my present favorite sort of thing, although how to implement it in quantum gravity I'm not at all confident with. I might say another one is that what you could do is take the fraction of actual observations where, because of course, I might imagine there's many regions where there's no observer at all. So in this case, you might divide by the number of sites where there actually is an observation. And do it that way. By the way, this is sort of what might be more natural if you believe in a collapse version of quantum theory. You might say that the quantum theory would collapse to some component of the wave function with it, probably given by the square of the amplitude. And then after it did collapse, you still, of course, wouldn't know where you were. But then you just have to take, you know, the fraction of the number of observations of the particular one you got divided by the total number of all observations. So this is what I would sort of expect if you had a collapsed version of quantum mechanics. In fact, a few years ago, I even wrote up a paper distinguishing between collapsed versions of quantum theory and other ones. By assuming the collapsed versions, you had this, and by Everett, you had this. But now I'm not so confident. I'm thinking even if you had Everett, in principle, the rule could be this, could be the same as if you had collapse, even if you don't have collapse. So I'm not sure but I think. Anyway, this is what you tend to get if you have collapse. So if the observations were consistent with this one, I think it would be some marginal evidence for collapse over the other.
Regions are separated in time? I mean, do they have to be separated in space only? Or?
Well, in principle, I'd like the thing eventually to be allowed to be separated in time, too. So, I mean, but it's perhaps easier to talk about the properties of these if they're spatial, because then you can imagine these individual projection operators commuting and so on. But if you don't, so there might be some technical issues in going, but I do really also imagine they might be, or I suppose another approach would be is you might say take the Wheeler-DeWitt approach and to say the separate times are just different components of the wave function. That you might say that each component of the wave function is a, you know, it's a three geometry in the matter fields on some hypersurface, so that at each component, all of the regions are spatial. So, but I'm not, you know, I'm not so confident the Wheeler-DeWitt approach is right. So there's a lot of technical stuff that would have to, you know, really be done with this. I mean, it's kind of, you know, I can say I prefer this over that, but I can't say completely how to implement. I mean, I think the second paper on that list at the beginning was where I proposed this particular thing. Now, in these cases,
particles, there would be no difference?
Well, if there was an observation that occurred at all the sites, then there wouldn't be a difference. But what I'm essentially having in mind is perhaps a universe that's very big, and I have some regions where there are observers and other regions where there aren't any observers. And so if there's a region where there's no observer, then I'm assuming there's no, you know, observation there. So the difference is particularly going to be important if you imagine, say, Boltzmann brains or something. The Boltzmann brains might take a very tiny fraction of the space, but yet in the very distant future, they might be almost all of the observations. So, you know, so if...
So what's the difference?
Three and
five.
Well, three, I count the total number, so therefore if an observation occurs, well, if there's bigger regions with more observations, that in some sense counts as more weight, because there's nothing in the denominator here. Whereas down here, I'm dividing by the number of sites that have an observation. But of course, that could also be very big. I mean, you have a very big universe, and there's lots of, even though there's a huge number of sites with no observations, there may be a huge number with observations. So this in naught could still be big. It wouldn't be as big as in. So that's it. So now the other, I can't say in these cases, you can say that the probabilities are expectation values of some operators, in these three cases at least. By the way, the numbers are historical, corresponding to the paper where I had one and two. So you can look at the paper for one. Well, maybe I mentioned them later. So the unnormalized one for a theory, it's just you sum up the projection operators over all the regions. For four, you do this, but for you have to restrict to given size of the universe. So this projection is to projects onto insight, and then within and then after you sum up over all the regions, you divide by the number of sites, and then at the end you do the sum over all possible sizes. Here you have to do the same, except you divide by the number of observations. So you've got to fix this projects onto the insights within the observations, and then you divide by that and so on. So, okay, so they're expectation values operators, but they're not projection operators. Okay, well, let me give a toy, very simplified toy model, where here I'll use slightly different notation. I'll assume that each component, I'll have two possible observations, but also the possibility that there's no observation. So the first number in each of these represents how many sites there are with no observation, no observer there at all, say. M1 and M2, it's the number of sites with a particular observation that we can classify as ordinary human observation, such as being in this room. Then in M2 or M3 is the number of sites with some highly disordered observation you might think is a Boltzmann brain, or let's say we would identify as a Boltzmann brain. Okay, then I put some numbers. I imagined that I had a superposition. This was supposed to represent sort of the observable part of the present universe. And basically, I took a region, I took an observer to be a human brain, and so I took a region roughly the volume of a human brain, and I said, well, at present, they're of order 10 to the 10 human brains. So that's the number of ordinary observations. And then the volume of space is roughly 10 to the 74 times the volume of a, or no, 10 to the 84 times the volume of a human brain. That's roughly the volume within our, going out to the horizon. So that's the present universe. And then I imagine that Wheeler-DeWitt proposed that this is some particular time in the future. And actually, I got this number from some decay time in the paper by, what is it, DeSimone, Guth, Lindy, Norbala, who was next? Salem and Blinken. So some paper. So this is, and I'm assuming the universe is expanded by the de Sitter expansion. So after this time, then the universe is expanded by 10 to the 56 e folds, and or I'm not distinguishing e folds and tenfolds. So the total volume is roughly that many human brains, and I'm assuming that ordinary stars have all died out by that time. So I'm assuming there's no ordinary observers. And then Boltzmann brains, well, they're very rare. I mean, I just picked up some number from one of my papers that the probability per four volume is 10 to the minus 10 to the 42. So it's a suppression factor 10 to the 42. But of course, you got this huge number of volume. So when you say even the fraction is 10 to the minus 10 to the 42, that subtracts off the exponent, but the exponent's much bigger. So there's still a huge number of Boltzmann brains there. So now, if you do the volume weighting, then you're basically counting by the numbers, and the idea is that this number is much larger than this number. So in some sense, that dominates. So if you calculate the probability of a human observation, then when you put the numbers in, you basically have got this divided by the sum of these things, and then normalized compared to this divided by the sum of these things. So it comes out to probability 10 to the minus 10 to the 56 minus 10 to the 42, and here's the 10 that came from that exponent up there. Of course, completely irrelevant compared to that, except for pedagogical purposes. So the probability of human observation would be extremely tiny in this way if I had these two components of the wave function that I did that. On the other hand, if I did the volume averaging, because I have to divide by the I divide by the total n, which is the total number of these sites in each case, then it comes out to be nearly 1, because even though the absolute number of humans is much less here than of Boltzmann brains, we take up a much bigger fraction of the volume. So, I mean, we're only 10 to the minus 74 of the volume. I mean, 10 to the minus 74 sounds pretty tiny. We're a tiny part of the universe, but we're much bigger fraction than the Boltzmann brains are in that distancing. So it comes out very nearly 1. On the other end, this observational average, where I divide by the number of observations, then it basically, well, because the observations either all this or all this, and it just comes out to be given by these coefficients in the front. So in this case, it would come out to be a half. So that's sort of ambiguous. Now, if I added a lot more, if I added a lot more components with a lot more times in the future, then there would be an awful lot more with Boltzmann brain. So this fraction would go down very much. This one would stay, and this one was already very low. This would stay high until the number of times, until the number of components got comparable to this 10 to the 10 to the 40 to the 42. So, but of course, if there's an infinite number of times in the future, then I might still have a Boltzmann brain problem if I have an infinite number of components out there in which the Boltzmann brains would. So it doesn't completely solve the Boltzmann brain problem to take this one versus this one if I allow, you know, an infinite number of components there with an infinite number of times where there's Boltzmann brains, but at least helps. It says if you can kill off the universe before it's exceptionally old, then you might solve that. Yes.
We find out our universe is finite. We compute various things. It's finite in space and time. Okay.
Right.
All right. And let's say at 5 billion years there's one civilization, and at 13 billion years, there's 100,000 civilizations. What would you say is the probability of living at 5 billion years compared to 13 billion years?
Well, okay. If the volume, let's see, Bo's, if the volume of space, I mean, okay, the volume of space is not going to be, is maybe bigger by a factor of, I don't know, 10, or I can't do the calculation in my head. But. So if the volume, yeah, so if the volume of space would be the same, if I did the volume averaging, yeah, then in some sense I'm dividing by the same capital N. So it would really just be counting the thing. So it would be weighted toward the 13, what'd you say, a million? I forgot how many more times you said. So I say a million times more civilizations at 10 to the, at 13 billion years. So then that they would be a million times more probable. So, yeah, I think in all of them. I mean, because you've got the same. Let's see, you've got the same N, and I guess the same. Well, wait a minute. No. Sorry, not in this one. Right. In this one, well. In this one, I guess not. In this, you would, if it were equal amplitudes, then it would just stay a half. Right. So this one would stay a half, but these two would be the same.
In simple situations, the volume weighting is somehow much more intuitive than any of the others.
It does sound more intuitive. I mean, I've written it myself. I mean, In fact, I've used volume weighting to defend years ago to defend the Harville-Hawking wave function against Alex's wave function, but then more recently, well, also Susskind's persuaded me that Harville-Hawking wave function is inconsistent with observations because it predicts not only Boltzmann brains in the distant future, but even now it predicts most likely an empty universe. So I tend to regard that as problems. So. Anyway, when Hawking himself sort of came back to advocating volume weighting, I'd actually earlier, but now that he's come back to it, I'm giving it up. So. Okay. Well, let's see. Another way of thinking about it is that you can say if you don't consider the global state, but local states. Let's line up a little better. Okay, and say Bode's rule doesn't work for the global state. You can't find state-independent projection operators, such as the probability of observations given by the expectation value of that, to satisfy reasonable properties such as the probability symmetry principle. But you might be able to find a local density matrix for a single site so that the probability is given by the expectation value of a local projection operator, or localized, for this particular density matrix. So now, if you knew the site was L, you could just take this to be the restriction of this to the Hilbert space of the site of that space. I mean, in other words, just take it to be that, except, of course, in the original version, this was supposed to be something that acted on the whole quantum state. It acts non-trivially on the region L, and it just acts like the identity in all the other regions. Here, of course, this one, because we're only talking about the Hilbert space of that region, this just acts there. It doesn't have to do anything on the other parts. Okay, if you wrote it this way, the ambiguity in the replacement of Barnes rule would be the ambiguity of how to calculate this density matrix for this local region from the global quantum state. So, okay, again, just like in the probabilities, it's sometimes easier to define unnormalized probabilities than to normalize it. So let's get an unnormalized density matrix and then normalize it. Of course, the unnormalized one has to be Hermitian with non-negative eigenvalues. So if the state is then a superposition over different sizes and different numbers of observations, then where this means you have in not observations in sites, then you could say, well, all right, the density matrix in the component of the wave function, where in one particular component of this, then the density matrix for this could be just tracing this over all the regions other than the L region. You're asking density matrix the L region, just trace over the other regions. But of course, there's also different numbers, different sites, and different L. So the volume weighting would be basically you just add up these density matrices with the squares of the amplitudes for each component of the wave function. For the volume averaging, you do almost the same, except you divide by the number of sites for in each component. And the observational averaging, you divide by the number of sites where there's actual observations. So that would be another way to do it. I don't know if this is related. I mean, some people, like Rafael Busso and others, argue that you know, we should give up talking about a global quantum state for the universe and just talk about localized things. Well, that might be, if you wanted to use Born's rule, maybe that's what you have to do. But in some sense, I'm saying, I don't see why we have to give up on a global quantum state. Maybe we just make the probability rules different. And it seems like we could still allow a global quantum state, but just have the probability rules not obey Born's rule. So anyway, I mean, of course, you could say, well, all right, as far as observation, maybe only this row sub I, maybe that's all that's important. But it might turn out that the global quantum state might be simpler than this row sub I. I mean, it might be, you know, since there's some procedure you'd have to go through to calculate this, it might be more complicated. So in some sense, you might say, even though there's no direct observational consequence of the whole thing, of the whole quantum, other than through this row sub I, you still might say it's the global quantum state is more fundamental. So maybe in that sense, I don't really see motivation for giving up the idea that there is a global quantum state. But of course, to predict the probabilities of observations, then that may be, you know, you maybe either have to restrict it or else have different rule. Now, let me say, not that I'm particularly advocating these, but just to point out, it seems to be logically possible that the probability rules could even be nonlinear. So I've considered linear rules where their expectation values operate. Now, they're not quite linear because of these denominators, but at least the unnormalized relative probabilities are just linear in operators that are independent of the state. The denominators do depend on the state, so even the ones I have maybe are not quite linear. But you could consider nonlinear rules and go back. There's what you might call Everett existence probability, and this is what some people have implicitly taken when they attack Everett view. They say, okay, let's suppose that the unnormalized probability, well, they don't actually talk about normalized and unnormalized, but it's effectively as if to say that the unnormalized probability is zero if all the projection operators for this observation are zero no matter where you are. But then say it's one if it's greater than zero for someplace. In other words, if there actually exists a non-zero amplitude for the observation to exist, then you could say that the observation exists, which I do believe in, but I don't believe that it exists with the same measure as Everett. But if you take the view that all of the ones that exist, all the ones in the Everettian sense, all of the ones that have non-zero probability, if you say they all exist with equal probability, then that would be one particular proposal, but I think that's not going to lead to our observations being as high as it would be from other theories, because it's going to give equal probabilities to a vastly greater set of observations than probably do have probabilities as high as ours. Well,
I mean, just for the fact that quantum mechanics works for predicting probabilities in lab experiments.
Yeah, I think you could say you would just get very. Right. I mean, it would say Yeah, I mean, it would say if you had, you know, if you had a million results and only 1,000 of them are very probable, then it would give observation probabilities, say, 1,000 times smaller than what you get from ordinary quantum theory. So yeah, so I think this pretty well could be ruled out. And so this one, I guess, is probably not logically possible, but I don't think it's tenable with observations. Well, this one I also doubt is tenable with observations, but you could take the probability that something occurs at least once somewhere, and those aren't normalized. You could normalize them. I didn't discuss that, but you could also normalize them with some coefficient different from one. Again, I don't know that that's. I don't really think this is going to fit with, because I think there's going to be too many of them that are going to have these things very near one. So I don't think that's going to work either. What surely would be consistent with observations, if any of these are consistent with observations in the previous form, which has the exponent exactly one, then surely it would be consistent with observation if the exponent were just a little bit different from one. So anyway, so as far as I can tell, there are strong tests about nonlinear evolution of quantum mechanics, that if the dynamical laws were slightly nonlinear, you could put very strong bounds that the nonlinear can't be very much. But for these things, I'm not so sure. I mean, these exponents, you know, if they're between, say, 0.8 and 1.2, I'm not sure how we could really tell the difference. So they obey this no extra vision principle. I mean, because you don't get any, the probability is zero if the amplitude is absolutely zero. The symmetry principle you also obey, because of course if the probabilities are equal, then you raise them to some power, they're still equal. So when you normalize them, you get equal. But they don't obey the probability fraction principle, because you know if you got a third and a two thirds and you raise it to some power, then the ratio of those probabilities is not the same. Okay, so then to maybe conclude, let me just talk about implications for the measure problem. Well, it's been pointed out before by Harlow Hawking and Blinken and Lindy and others that, you know, dynamical theory of everything isn't really a theory of everything. You also need the quantum state. But then this work I'm pointing out, the quantum state is also not enough. You also need the rules for extracting the probabilities. So I think this implies that the measure problem in cosmology, it's more serious than might have been thought. You can't be solved by just knowing the quantum state. Now, I don't know if anybody thought. I mean, you know, perhaps some of us thought that, well, you know, all this is just all this stuff with the measure problem, it's just temporary. Once we know what the quantum state is, can do the calculation, then the problem will be solved. We won't, you know, so it's just a matter of finding the quantum state and calculating using Born's rule to calculate from. But I'm saying that Born's rule doesn't work in cosmology. We do need it, no extra rules, and as far as I can tell, we don't really know what they are. We don't know whether they're volume weighting, volume averaging, or something else. So volume weighting, volume averaging, observational, have seemed the simplest rules that I've thought of so far. Volume weighting is part, you know, a large number of us have used, and observational averaging tend to lead to a late time Boltzmann brain problem, although there are other, you know, possible solutions to this. I'm not saying it's the only solution. Volume averaging can ameliorate this, although it does seem to require that you don't have too many components in the future that may require a lifetime less than this to work, which I gather is presumably consistent with string theory, but not absolutely guaranteed by string theory. Now, of course, you know, this is just one aspect. I mean, you do need a good quantum state, and I think I mentioned a little bit ago, the Harlow-Hawking no boundaries proposal seems to have an early time Boltzmann brain problem. Because of the huge negative Euclidean action, it predicts most probably an empty de Sitter universe. And then even if you said, well, that would have no observers in it, even if you allow observers, it's most probable an observer would just occur most likely by quantum fluctuation. If you're somewhat perverse and say an observer requires a whole solar system to exist, well, you could, at the cost of greater action and making the probability much less, you could just have a whole Boltzmann solar system form and last for the age of the universe is a thermal fluctuation in de Sitter space, and that would still be much more probable than having the entire universe we see. So Harlow-Hawking one, as far as I can see, it doesn't give any reason for us to expect to see distant large-scale structures. For example, seeing stars, I think, would be extremely improbable in that. So you need something else, and my best guess is what I might call a symmetric bounce quantum state, where, and I just posted something on the archive on Friday with the erroneous thought, I had to Monday to correct it, and then on Monday our physics department computers went down. So it's still got a lot of little bugs in it, and there's a few things I need to. It's mostly, well, I shouldn't say right. It's mostly the way I intended to. It's mostly the way I intended to be, but there's a few numerical errors and a few cases where I have a fraction upside down and a few references that are, well, anyway, there's some corrections I should make, so maybe I'll get that. No. It's basically assuming that each state that you have in a throat, you have a scalar field, or the inflaton is has the time derivative zero there. So it's you have a symmetric, well, and the gravitational field is symmetric about that point. But then of course you have quantum fluctuations, and so the assumption is that at that moment on that hypersurface, the quantum state is exactly the same as the Bunch-Davis vacuum in a De Sitter space of that same size. So the background is just a three sphere, and then you just take the momentary vacuum in that state. But then the thing evolves to the past and the future, and the inflaton, mean, of course, it doesn't say exactly De Sitter, so then you get the traditional inflation, and generation of inhomogeneities, the same way you do an inflation by having you start in the ground state. And that part's rather similar to what you get from Harlow-Hawking or Vilenkin, but at least you avoid the huge negative action. You don't have any negative actions that you put in there to weight anti-De Sitter. So maybe that's better. Okay, in any case, it seems that Born's rule does not work, or as Brandon Carter suggests, it's inapplicable in cosmology when the universe is sufficiently large to have many copies of an observation. So I rest my case.
Yes?
So I'm curious about your commentary. So you said, well, maybe it's okay to have these infinite universes because all we need is a new probability rule. But given that already the problem with the infinite universes is the measure problem, and you've just added another layer of measure, it sounds pretty bad to me.
Yeah,
it certainly drives me to wonder if there's a sort of cosmic censorship that the Hilbert space can't be too big or something, so you don't.
So it's really
a finite universe.
Yeah, I must say, I mean, nothing.
In some sense, I'm saying the problem is prior to the regularization. I mean, I'm saying there's an ambiguity even before you get to the issue of how do you regularize to the infinite. And I don't have any good suggestions at all about regularizing the infinite case, although, you know, if you start off with volume averaging rather than volume weighting and then try to do a regularization, I think it might be somewhat easier, or you're less likely to run into the Boltzmann brain problem. But I don't know. I mean, I do have the wondering, is the Hilbert space really finite? And, you know, if so, maybe, well, I don't know. I mean,
of course, maybe you could have a component of the wave function which corresponds to infinite volume, although I guess you wouldn't have an infinite number of degrees of freedom, I suppose, if that. So, yeah, I don't know. Or maybe.
It's pretty disturbing anyway.
You know, or maybe at least you might say the local region, that density matrix where the observation could occur, maybe at least that part of the quantum state should have just a finite Hilbert space. And then, you know, so at least, I mean, I guess that might be a goal. If you just tried to calculate density matrix for the laboratory, then, you know, you'd think that you ought to be able to get by with a finite dimensional Hilbert space. You know, imagine your laboratory could be enclosed in a sphere, and then you just take exponential of a quarter of the area of the sphere, and that should be enough states to describe anything inside, I would think, and then you do it for that. But how do you get that from the global state? I don't know. Let's see. Did you have, all right, let's go to Alex.
So you say the problem exists if you have the universe which is sufficiently large. So I'm wondering if the problem gets better if you have really eternal universe which is infinite. In the limit. The thing is that if you have, suppose we think in terms of Everett interpretations, we have many branches, many copies of the universe, and some of them are finite, so produce a finite number, so your number n will be different in these different branches, and there you'll have a problem. But these finite branches will not really contribute if we are going to do any kind of averaging of the size of the type you are proposing. If you focus on the branches.
Well, okay, well, go on, but I might object to that, because if I did the volume averaging, then I don't see any reason why the very large n would dominate. So I don't see, in other words, if I do the volume averaging, it seems like I lose the motivation for much of eternal inflation, because I'm not giving bigger weight to more volume.
Sorry, I don't like volume averaging.
Okay.
I like volume averaging. So, but
okay.
Suppose we focus on those branches where the number of observations is infinite.
Okay.
And most of them, except maybe a set of measure zero, will be statistically equivalent, because if you evolve them to sufficiently late times, then if you have observations of different times, they will occur at some fixed fractions. So the fact that you have several large number of branches doesn't really change anything. And if you average between these branches in any way you wish, you will still get the same result that you would get from any one of these branches. So could that help with these problems?
Well, I guess if you have maybe an infinite number, if you have infinitely more components of the wave function, which the universe is infinitely large than the finite ones, then I suppose probably even that would win against any of these. Now, if the amplitudes for the universe to be infinitely large are just comparable to the amplitudes for it to be a finite size, then if I do volume averaging instead of volume weighting, then I don't give any preference for the infinite size ones. So it could be the finite size ones could contribute, and of course that could mean in the end that maybe it's not correct to go to this asymptotic limit of infinite size. I mean, I agree, if you took volume weighting, so you get more weight to when there's more observers, then you're going to tend to want to do an arbitrarily large amount of inflation. So that supports sort of a lot of the conclusions from, eternal inflation. But if you do volume averaging, then it's not so clear that you should do that. I mean, maybe significant part of the weighting can come from when the universe has just got a finite, a finite size. So it's not obvious to me that it is going to be dominated by the late times. I mean, that seems to beg the question as to whether it's, volume averaging or volume weighting.
I think it's pretty well motivated to just weigh all of the frogs equally. Whether the frogs are separated in space or they're separated in time or they're separated
right.
in different pieces of the wave function, just weight them all equally.
Right,
which is, I guess, what you call volume.
Yeah, because it's basically weighting. Yeah, it's weighting if the universe is bigger, it's sort of weighting. But it's not so obvious to me why should a bigger universe count for more? I mean, if how do we know? Maybe it's the density of
the
Earth.
There's more frogs there. So if we're randomly,
anyway. Yeah, it might depend on whether you make your quantum state. I mean, in some sense, if your Hilbert space somehow saturates, I don't know, that you don't, making more copies doesn't really increase things. I don't know. Okay.
So I'm really intrigued by the relationship to how we treat identical particles. Where I think if we didn't make the assumptions we do about the wave function for identical particles, we be in a similar situation. And I'm just going to leave that as a comment. I hope we get, I'm going to talk more about that in my talk, which is the end, but I hope we have some interesting conversations during the meeting, before the end.
Yeah,
I think there's some very interesting sort of reflections on that to have.
Right. Yeah, and imagine, you could imagine, of course, if you imagine that an individual hydrogen atom say could be conscious or make an observation or something, then of course you have a large number of, for practical purposes, identical ones. And you might imagine, well, maybe each one could see how many oxygen atoms or, is there another hydrogen atom nearby or another oxygen atom nearby? You can run into similar things because of course there's not a unique hydrogen atom. You'd have to, in some sense, maybe you could do this counting of what fraction of hydrogen atoms have an oxygen atom. Maybe another hydrogen and oxygen in your box, and they're, make up water. You can raise similar issues. It's just, I suppose.
Statistics theorems avoid that.
So I think that may be wrong. See, I think the reason, the problem would apply, I think, for the particles. I suppose the point might be that we haven't thought of it so much before is that we tend not to think of the, these individual particles are doing observation. We tend to think that, you know, it's a big laboratory. And if you specify all the conditions, all the results of the observation, then, well, or calculate conditional probabilities, conditional upon all your memory of having set up the experiment in such and such a way, and then you calculate the conditional probability, given that, what's the result of your observation? The conditions may have so many details that it's extremely unlikely that the conditions would be replicated, you know, within the observable part of the universe. So you don't, you can more or less say, well, if I, as long as I put enough conditions in, for then the observation's fairly unique. Now that wouldn't be true if you just had the conditions for a hydrogen atom. Then of course it could be many of them. But so in some sense, for a real laboratory, the problem only seems to arise, well, it seems to necessarily arise. You can't get around it by using conditional probabilities if the actual conditions are replicated out there, and which, you know, seem to be in enough inflation, it could be.
So actually, along the same lines, it wasn't clear to me how many of these problems you would have even without cosmology. In other words, if you just didn't believe in the Born rule and you like Everett, then already you need some rule to compute probabilities from an Everett wave function, which is presumably that you take the amplitude of each branch, and that amplitude squared is the probability that you find yourself there. And if you sort of run that for long enough, the wave function fragments into this enormous number of branches, which are a lot like the copies that you find in the large universe. So do you run into these problems anyway, even if you didn't have a large enough universe to have copies?
Yeah, I suppose you might if you allowed it to, I mean, it, yeah, if you just allowed it to last.
You just allowed it, yeah, to
last. I mean, that is cosmology. That's a cosmology in some sense, but it doesn't need
yeah,
gravity, really.
Just be one room.
You need a big cover.
One room, yeah. No, I mean, it might. Yeah. I suppose even though if the laboratory wasn't too big, then, you know, if let's suppose you had some external time, so you're imagining this thing branching off and something. I mean,
but
okay,
it was finite, you'd have recurrences,
pardon?
As you know. I mean, if you make it too small, you'll have recurrences. You really won't get the diversity that you want. So you need to make it big. You need to make
yeah, okay, so big that you're going to have. Yeah, so I suppose you could. Yeah, I mean, you might get the same thing if you allowed it at different times. I mean, you might say, well, you could have the observation now and you could have it later. And how do you weight these two different? Because, I mean, assume the observer doesn't know the absolute time. I mean, even if there is some external time, we may not have.
If you forget your past a little bit, then you could sort of be at two places, and so then you have a very similar.
Yeah. I think, okay, that's probably true. You could have a similar problem even without. You just need it either big enough in space and time that I think more or less the same thing could recur. I mean, either in time or in space, I don't think it makes much difference which. Mm-hmm. Yes, Al.
It just occurred to me, could you, maybe you don't really need a large universe. Maybe you could prepare this thing in laboratory by creating identical rooms, putting the observers who will be frogs, you will be the bird. You will know who is where, but each of those observers will try to make predictions, and you will write the wave function for all of them. So what's the difference? So would you say that in this setting you can create the same problem and say that quantum mechanics doesn't apply even on the usual terrestrial?
Well, you might be able to, but I suppose what I'm saying is that these observers, I think it'd be very difficult for me to create two copies that are sort of indistinguishable as seen, you know, by real observer inside. I mean, I could try to make a copy, but I mean,
the observer will know their names, but they will not know which room they're in and which apparatus they are actually observing.
Don't give them any ideas.
I think Alex is right, but it's just, it seems like a less compelling problem because that's just because you're dumb and don't want to get out of your room. Whereas a physicist, we're used to expecting physicists to do whatever it takes.
No, but if we have the same problem, then we should use the solution that will give us the usual rules of quantum mechanics and then apply that solution in cosmology.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I think what I'm saying that is if the number of regions is sort of fixed, if there isn't a quantum superposition of different sizes, then I pretty much agree on what the solution should be. I mean, it would be the volume averaging, volume weighting, observational averaging, they all give the same result. So I would tend to go with it. I mean, they're indistinguishable. I tend to go with them. It's just in the case, the part that seems, I mean, I agree that logically it could be something different. But since, you know, I think there is a preferred answer there, but when the preferred answer doesn't really tell us what to expect is when it's a superposition of different sizes. And then it's just not clear to me whether to use volume weighting, which I admit I prefer. But with the Boltzmann-Brain problem, I'm tending to think, well, maybe that's not best. Maybe we should use, you know, volume averaging. And then after DeRose, you could say, well, even if the Boltzmann-Brain problem is solved by some other room, I mean, how do I know that volume averaging isn't the right thing to do? I mean, maybe, you know, even if you don't believe my motivation, if you think, well, we could solve the Boltzmann-Brain problem without it, you could still say, well, at least it came forward. I mean, just like Einstein's cosmological constant, he didn't really have a good motivation for having a non-zero at the time, but it turned out to be correct, or at least we sort of think it's correct. So I'm just saying, even if you dismiss my motivation for volume averaging, how do we know that it's not the right answer?
So maybe on that note, we can thank them again.